You know how people rarely fill out surveys because they're too much work? Well, KISS Insights offers surveys that are so easy to fill out that people will actually use them and give you valuable feedback. KISSinsights.com. Try them for free. If your email goes down, who can you call? When DNA Mail manages your hosted exchange, they'll make sure you have dependable email service. And if you want Google Apps, they have that too. DNAMail.com. They even have 24/7 phone support. Do you have an idea for an online store? Or maybe you want to improve your current store's sales. With Shopify.com, you'll get a store that's optimized to get web users to buy. Shopify.com. Here's a sample site. Let's go to the program. Hey everyone, it's Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy.com, home of the ambitious upstart. And today's guest, I think, proves that the top people in the tech startup world come and do interviews here on Mixergy. Today's guest is John Steinberg. He is a venture capitalist, angel investor, vineyard owner here in Mendoza, Argentina, and event ticket collector. I'm going to ask him about that. His investments have included Spinner, Evite, Infospace, Seagate, StubHub, whose founder came here to talk about how he launched that company and sold it for $310 million to eBay. John, welcome to Mixergy.
Good to be here. Nice to see you.
So I plan to ask you about the investments that you've made. I plan to ask how you got into investing in the first place. But why don't we talk about this? These ticket stubs that you have? What is that?
You know, I am a person who follows their passions. And from a very early age, having grown up in Omaha, Nebraska, I was a Go Big Red Cornhusker fan, and went to my first game when I was 3 years old. Thought the ticket stubs were a great way to remember the moment and actually mark the moment in a way that other ways don't. And over the years, it also is for me a really interesting blending of what technology is or isn't, as we've moved to bar scans, as tickets have become more fungible at StubHub. You know, it actually helped pique my interest in that. But also the art aspect of a lot of stubs and what the future of a stub is. As you can see, it's dramatically changing. And even the technology in stubs around counterfeiting. So for me, it actually is, it covers a lot of my passions from art and technology and my love of sports. I've got about 50,000 stubs at this point. I've bought a fair amount on eBay. I've never sold a stub. If anyone out there has any sports ticket stubs that they don't want, I would love them. I hope to donate them all to a museum collection at some point. And if anybody has today's opening South Africa game stub, that's a beautiful one. So anyway, that's where it comes from, and I continue to collect.
You know what? I used to be a collector in my, I guess, in my childhood and in my teens, and then at some point I just had to stop because I'd have all these collections waiting for something big to come of them, either for them to all get so valuable that I could sell them or for them to finally be a complete set, which they never are. And I had to just stop myself. Is this the only collection you have, or are there secret other stashes that you've got around the house?
Well, it's funny. I actually had, I don't tell this to very many people, but I actually had one of the world's largest Mad Magazine collections. However, I came home from college one day and my mother had given them away. So this is the only one after that debacle.
Okay. And I saw that you're an investor in a vineyard in Mendoza. I happen to be here in Buenos Aires. I visited some of the places that I've seen you blog about or get asked about in past interviews. Where did this interest in wines come from?
Well, it's interesting. I, having grown up in Nebraska, we weren't farmers, but we were literally surrounded by farmland and cornfields. And I used to spend my summers on farms. So when I went to Stanford, being so close to Napa, one of the first things I did is I went out to Napa just because I thought it was beautiful. And, you know, making wine is... a lot of it is farming, and you know, people think of it as some romantic story tale kind of business, but a lot of it is getting in the dirt and being a farmer. And I like that aspect of it, to be honest with you. But really it started when I went out in to the West Coast from Nebraska and saw Napa and fell in love with it. And ever since then, I've always, wherever I've traveled, gone to the wine regions as part of a trip because I think they're just beautiful places, including Early, I even went to the South Africa wine region, speaking of the World Cup today, which, by the way, for people who haven't been there, is one of the most beautiful places in the world. But about 5 years ago, I just had a week that I could go travel, and I would call travel a little bit of my heroin, and I need to get out of the country on a regular basis. And people had been talking about, I kind of have my bucket list of travel places, and Argentina was on it. And I went there on a whim, not really knowing what I was going to do, but using the power of LinkedIn and Facebook, ended up meeting some incredible people. One of the things I did was just through my Stanford alumni directory, also looked at who was in Argentina. And one of the guys was a guy by the name of Santiago Achával, who turns out we went to I also went to Stanford Business School, and he was a class behind me. We didn't really know each other very well. He had kids and was married at the time and lived off campus. But he agreed to meet. And the way I tell the story is I went to his vineyard, Achával Ferrer, and had a glass of wine with him. That glass became two glasses. That became a bottle. That became an asado. That became several bottles. And after 5 hours, I said, Santiago, if I bought some land, would you be the winemaker? And we shook hands and said, yeah, that would be fun. And literally, that's how it happened. And, you know, the way I think about it is, I'm gonna preempt any of your audience saying the joke about how you make a small fortune. The way you do that is you start with a large one and go into the wine business. It seems like everybody tells me that, and it is a brutally hard business. But from a business aspect, I think we have several things that are in our favor. One is, as you know, our costs compared to Napa Valley or other places are significantly different. I'm not saying it's a complete apples-to-apples comparison, but I do think that we can create a $30-$35 bottle of great Malbec that compares really well with a $75 Napa Valley cab. And even at that price point difference, we still have a cost advantage. The second thing is Santiago. Since we agreed to do this, he has gotten the highest rating by Robert Parker in the country. He's gotten the highest rating by Spectator. He's been top 100 4 years in a row now with Spectator. And this is all for Achával Ferrer, but now this will be his second label. Also, he was named Winemaker of the Year in the world last year by Wine and Spirits. And literally just in the last couple weeks, Spectator called him Master of Malbec in a country that is known for its Malbec. So he's en fuego, as I like to say. And it's really exciting working with him because he has the business mind, but he also has the winemaking side. So part art, part science, and that's really exciting. So we have the cost advantage, we have Santiago advantage, if you will, and we also have the advantage of a region that has always produced great wine but wasn't very international in outlook, and now you're seeing a lot more Argentine wines come into this market. Our market is the U.S. market. And so we're a boutique winery. We're going to sell a couple thousand cases, kind of on the ad. We'll have mostly Malbec. We'll have a Viognier. We're mostly going to sell around the $30, $35 price point. So not the low end, but not the highest end either. We're really trying for huge value in that bottle of wine for what people are going to get.
I'm sorry. So that brings up a question in my mind.
Sure.
You go in, you sit down with this guy who you didn't even know in school, but he happened to go to your school. You have a great asado, great barbecue with him, and a great conversation. Boom, you go into business with him, and he ends up not only being a great manager of your new vineyard, but also being one of the top guys in the space. Picking people, picking the right people is one of the most important aspects of business. I want to go deeper, because if we leave people with this, if we leave Andrew here with a simplistic understanding of, hey, if you click over wine, then you're fine, then I think we missed the bigger lesson. How did you know he would be the right person to bank on?
You know, you can learn a lot about a person over a couple of bottles of wine in a 5-hour discussion. And Santiago impressed me then and continues to impress me with his unending curiosity and thirst for figuring out how to ever be better.
But you could tell that in a 5-hour conversation with the guy? How?
Absolutely. This is a guy that never was in the wine business until he went to Stanford and fell in love with Napa. We both shared that story. He went back and said, I'm going to go follow my passion. He's an engineer by background, so he's got the scientific mind, but he also went to business school. So as he talked about, I actually asked him, how did you get into this? Tell me about your learning. He studied with the best. By his book stand next to his bed, he's got books that he's reading constantly about new techniques, learning more and more and more. I could tell. And by the way, I loved his wine.
His what?
His wine.
Ah.
I tasted his wine. I loved it. So that's, I wish I could do that with entrepreneurs sometimes. Show me your code. Show me your product. This is a guy I actually got to taste the expression of everything he's about through his wine. So for me, it was really obvious. And I'm going to say this too, and maybe this is fair or isn't fair, but he went to Stanford Business School. That's not a bad filter. It's not a perfect filter, but it's not a bad one as a starting point.
And then do you have safeguards in place in case this doesn't work? Or you do, of course.
Yeah, so we think about that all the time. We talk about it all the time. You know, we never have a conversation where we don't talk about risk factors. He is an incredibly important part to this whole puzzle, and so I have Keyman life insurance on him, as an example. We are out, you know, we're taking investors in, and we're building a founders club around this, and I just wanted to be able to tell people that the answer to that very question. What happens if? So yeah, we're constantly thinking about that.
Okay. I also am dying to ask you, I want to get to the tech stuff, but I'm also dying to ask you about Vines of Mendoza. You're an investor in Vines of Mendoza too?
Yeah.
How do you explain to people who've never been there? And by the way, here's how I met them. I did Leo Laporte's This Week in Tech. Mike, I think it was, from Vines of Mendoza happened to listen to me. He said, if you're ever in Mendoza, stop by. And that very minute, I was planning to go over to his, not a restaurant, his wine tasting room in Mendoza.
Yeah.
We missed each other. I ended up going to an asado. I love the place. It was beautiful. So anyway, how do you describe to people what it is?
Well, you know, I think that's a great story in itself. And it sounds like you've talked to Mike. And they were instrumental in my getting involved there. Vines of Mendoza is a startup that is basically focused on selling private vineyards, mostly to foreigners, people who say, maybe I can't afford Napa, or I just love Argentina, and I want to own a 3 to 10 acre vineyard of my own. And I'll make some wine, I'll sell some fruit, maybe I'll build a house on it, and we'll create a community. And my land is literally next door to the Vines of Mendoza private vineyards. And they service our land. So they're a great neighbor because they keep watch on it, they do very high quality work. I actually helped them raise money, and I helped, I was on their advisory board for a while. I've introduced them to a lot of the owners, and I introduced them, maybe most importantly, to Santiago. So he's the consulting winemaker there. So they are, I think, a really exciting startup. And we're thrilled to be next door to him. And I talk to him all the time, and it's actually a really nice symbiotic relationship. And by the way, you know, one of the things, I don't think you're going to ask this, but, you know, the really hard question in my mind, how do you manage something that far away? Something that has a country that has different laws, it speaks a different language, culturally different. Well, I wouldn't have done this without Santiago, for sure, number one. But two, knowing that the Vines is there also, it gives me great comfort. And people need to think about that as they are thinking about risk. That's a risk factor. The politics of the country is a risk factor. The distance is a risk factor. So all of those I felt I had to mitigate in some way, and having these relationships are an important part of that.
Okay, let's get into how you became an investor, because I was looking at your LinkedIn profile the way I usually do to start research on one of my guests. And I saw Microsoft during Microsoft's peak when they were on top of the world. Then you go on to AOL. Then I see a big blank space, yada, yada, yada. You're suddenly an advisory partner at Rustic Canyon, and you're at your own venture firm.
So I've always gone back and forth between being an entrepreneur and running investments. That's kind of always been whether early in my career I did real estate investing. From Stanford, I went to Microsoft because back then, believe it or not, it was entrepreneurial. It was small. I never thought I would stay for 6 years, but because it was so interesting, I did. And then after that, I left Microsoft and helped start a company called Virtual.io, which is a startup. And then I did a chain of car washes as a startup. And then I got back into the investing side, where I actually raised two venture funds. One was called Steinberg Venture One, and the second one was Steinberg Ventures Two. And I tried to think, and I do in every one of these situations, what can we bring to the table that's going to be different? So, and sometimes it's technology, sometimes it's a distribution model, right? Sometimes it could just be location, but what can we do differently? And so for the venture fund, what I said was, I'm never going to compete with Kleiner and Sequoia and Benchmark and all the NEA and all these big guys. I'm never going to have that kind of gunpowder. I'm never going to have the reach, the resources. So what can I do? Well, at the time, I was very, very deeply connected to Microsoft. At the time, everyone cared about Microsoft in terms of, are they competitive? Are they a potential acquirer? And Seattle is a very natural place for the Valley to partner with. And so I basically came out and said, I'm the bridge from Seattle to San Francisco. I'm going to be that guy that kind of goes between the two places, and I'm going to put a little bit of money in other people's deals, and the trade-off is I'm going to help be their guy in Seattle. So I literally did deals with every firm I just named. And so if I put $250,000 or $500,000 in, they viewed it as not terribly dilutive to what they were doing, but a big value add, because I could provide this outpost for them and this watchguard for them on things they cared about with as it relates to the companies they were investing in, if that makes sense.
Can you give me an example?
Sure. I mean, there's lots of examples. But, if you're a company going into the – and remember, this is back in this is 5-10 years ago. If you're a company going into the enterprise space, you'd love to have a guy who can tell you, what is Microsoft doing around that? Are they going to go into that space? What are they working on behind closed doors? Are they potentially going to acquire to be in that space?
Can you give me a specific example of a company that you invested in and then went as a and then were a go-between?
Well, sure. I mean, Spinner wanted to know, was Microsoft going into the music business, right? I mean, just flat out, right? And what were their plans around that? Right, and I do a lot of investing in enterprise deals in Microsoft. That continues to be their strength today. People were always asking, you know, how can we work with them? How can we be part of their ecosystem? One company I did was a company that focused exclusively on the Microsoft partner channel for selling CRM and Great Plains. And basically, because we had such close ties to Microsoft, we could be at, you know, literally, we could go walk into Jeff Rakes or Ballmer or Gates and say, hey, we want to work with you guys. Here's this company, you know, and could you direct us to the people at Microsoft that we should be connected with?
I see. All right. What did you start with? What was the first investment? Was it real estate? Was it, it wasn't the car wash. Was it something outside of tech, or was it tech? What was it?
So you're going way back, but I would say actually my first startup was a chocolate chip cookie delivery company on the Stanford campus.
Okay.
And I did that for a couple of years, and then I also had a t-shirt company.
In school, while you were still at Stanford, both those businesses.
Yeah. Right.
Can you tell me about them?
I mean, they were simple little businesses, but I knew, you know, during finals week, everybody wanted cookies, you know, to sort of, it's, you know, midnight. If you didn't always want Domino's, and so I had dorm reps, and we set up a network on campus, and you know it paid some bills and gave me extra spending money, and then the t-shirt company, we would go to the football games, and there were a couple of us that started this, and we'd have t-shirts we'd sell along the road, and again, you know, but they were just opportunities again. where people weren't doing. In both cases, nobody was doing those things, so we decided to do it.
What's a door rep? You said that you had door reps to promote the cookies.
No, we had dorm reps.
So dorm reps.
Right, we would literally, if they would get a certain number of people buying cookies, they'd get free cookies. We'd spiff them.
You know what? I'm sorry to linger on this, but I'm really curious, and I also think that these early businesses say a lot about the evolution of the investor and entrepreneur. So let's see. Instead of just buying cookies the way I imagined you did and then just having them around for somebody to come by, you had a whole system in place. What was that system? How'd you start it? How'd you build it? Tell me.
Well, I actually, one of the people in my dorm, it all started when I tasted her cookies and I thought, these are unbelievable. Okay. And I said to her, you know, could we do these on a bigger scale? And she loved baking. Now, I suppose we could have become Mrs. Fields, but that wasn't our goal. I mean, it was truly an opportunity to have some extra spending money. And you know, it started in our dorm, and then it started in the dorms around us. And pretty soon people were hearing about these things. And back then, we didn't have the internet. We couldn't do internet orders, so it was basically the telephone. But because we had the dorm reps in the different dorms, that people knew that they could go and say, I really want to get some cookies. And then we started doing, you know, the dorms, every dorm would have monthly meetings, and we would supply the monthly meetings, and we'd figure out, you know, how do we take it to another level? And the other thing I did that, you know, speaking of which, maybe I shouldn't talk about, but a couple of friends, we started the first Calcutta at Stanford, where we would bid off the NCAA March Madness basketball tournament.
Uh-huh.
And so every year we would have this, there are 64 teams in the tournament. We would have an auction. And that too created, at the end of it, and we had to quit because it got too big, we had $50,000 pot. I mean, it became crazy. The first year was a couple thousand bucks, but then the law school heard about it, the business school heard about it. We got a bunch of people. So, you know, college campuses are fantastic research labs for trying out ideas, right? And I really would encourage people who are in school, in college, in universities, to view it as a great chance. I mean, what's the downside on these things? Our costs were minimal. So
she baked all the cookies herself?
She did. Well, then we had to get a crew.
Okay, but yeah. Wow. All right, so then you go to Microsoft. Do you do any investing while you're at Microsoft? Is that where you did real estate?
I did. I would, on the side, I actually, one of my goals early on was to try and do one house a year, fix it up, and sell it. And fortunately, Seattle was growing at the time, and Microsoft was contributing greatly to that. And so, you know, these weren't big projects, but almost every year I would find a fixer-upper and do that. And I probably did 10 of those over the first 10 years.
Did you do it yourself, the fixer-upping?
I would hire out. I would find the house. I didn't have time. Working at Microsoft, I literally, there were nights where I'd sleep there. There was a period where I slept there three nights in a row, just because we had so much work to do. So I couldn't do that. But you know, I got a team, kind of an outsourcing is now normal, but back then it wasn't. But we kind of had an outsourced team that would go in and do the variety of tasks to get it ready to sell it.
Now, again, it's hard to even have somebody come in your house and fix the bathroom. To redo the kitchen is a nightmare for the whole family. You're managing somebody while you're working and sleeping at Microsoft. How are you able to do that? How did that work out?
I'm just very lucky because I have a lot of energy. I don't need a lot of sleep, and I get very, there's lots of adrenaline around ideas. I'm passionate about pursuing new ideas, looking at business models. And so for me, it just was something I did. You know, I always had a job from the time I was 14. And in college, even though I would take big workloads, I always had a job. And so, you know, kind of being that guy that does the extra things is just kind of normal for me.
I could see that, by the way, with the energy. Most people, they've got a Skype video camera in their face. They're still a little nervous, still a little quiet, and you're just in there. I love it. And by the way, just to give people reference, you were at Microsoft from 88 to 95. You got there before Windows 3.0 came out. You got there before Microsoft Office took off, before it even came out. You were right there just before all these big things happened.
Good to be lucky.
Do you have any stories about Bill Gates or Steve Ballmer from back in the day?
Well, you know, it's funny. I wasn't going to go to Microsoft. I thought it was too big a company. I really wanted to do something on my own, maybe real estate investing. I really thought, gosh, I'll do the interview because I'd never been to Seattle. And they were like, we'll fly you up. And I like Seattle. But the reason I went there was it was the most interesting set of interviews I've ever had in my life. It was 12 back-to-back interviews with hardcore cases, people who were fired up about what they were doing. And the way they did interviewing back then is that people would say, here's what I'm working on. Tell me what you would do. And so they weren't made up, sort of pie in the sky. Yeah, there's the famous Microsoft questions. Those were fine. But really, it was about what are people working on? So you get a great sense of what people are working on. And I thought, if these people are this fired up, this smart, I'm going to learn a lot here. And I'll probably stay here for a year and leave. But this could be a really interesting thing. And I tell you, I've never been around, and I just feel very fortunate, such smart, such passionate people. And it showed in the early days. And that's why I stayed there. And I was just at Google. In fact, you can't see it, but across the street, that building is Google, San Francisco. I look into their ping pong room. And I was just there before this interview. And I was saying to the guy, as we were eating our lox for breakfast, quite a breakfast spread there. We didn't have that at Microsoft. We were thrilled to have free Coke. I was saying to him, you know, being at Microsoft is different than you now being at Google. Because being at Google now, people know it's a very special place and that they're rising and they're the kingpins. Now, when we were at Microsoft, we never felt that. We felt like, God, we're being attacked by Lotus and we're behind on 1, 2, 3 and we're perfect kicking our butt. And God, you know, if we could just get an operating system out that people loved and the graphical user interface, we got to get that adopted. So, you know, true story is when I made the decision to go to Microsoft, there's an options pricing model called the Black-Scholes model. And so I ran that as part of my, and I got paid, my salary at Microsoft first year was $40,000 a year. And I ran the 4-year vesting Black-Scholes model, and it was going to equate to about a $50,000 all in. So I was going to make about $50,000 a year for 4 years. So I certainly didn't go there for the money, and I didn't think that it was going to have the run it did. So again, I followed it because one of my tenets is surround yourself with great people. And these people seem like they were amazing. And by the way, what's interesting, just a complete side note, but I want to mention it. I am, in addition to the Vineyard, I still do a little bit coaching and advising to startups. And I am currently advising a Microsoft spinout. From the guy who started it was my first interview at Microsoft some 20 years ago, and he's now doing a startup. So, you know, surround yourself with great people, stay connected to them, and good things happen.
What's the company?
It's called Moprise. They are doing something really interesting around creating a mobile front end for SharePoint. If you don't know what SharePoint is, it's a juggernaut for Microsoft. It's basically a workgroup workflow, a product that's included in the Office suite. It's on 150 million users' desks right now and growing to 250 shortly.
I've got this note here about the car wash. I got to get to the tech, but car wash, that too. How'd you get into the car wash business? Before you get into that, can you just lower your camera a little bit? I want to make sure that you're fully in the frame. Yeah,
sure.
Perfect.
How's that?
Yeah.
So I left Microsoft and thought, I want to do something entrepreneurial again. And I want to go somewhere where there's not a lot of MBAs, there hasn't been a lot of innovation, that maybe there was a good cash flow component, that there was kind of a reoccurring revenue. And there was another guy at Microsoft who had found these guys who were not franchising legally, but sort of in the concept of franchising car washes. And I went over to Eastern Washington, and it reminded me of Omaha, Nebraska, quite frankly. And so I felt comfortable, and I thought, let's bring a different marketing and branding ideal to a car wash. And so we invented the concept of something called Go Spot Go. And we built a chain of 5 car washes in Spokane, and I learned a lot. You know, I would, at the end of the day, we didn't lose money, we didn't make money. You know, I go back to what I said about Microsoft, and I wasn't very passionate about car washes. I wasn't surrounded by amazing people. And I didn't really, it turns out that the people who sold me the car wash concept were later indicted and went to jail for misrepresenting the numbers and so forth. So, you know, arguably I should have done a better job on my due diligence, although we spent a lot of time with these guys. They were very good. So a lot of lessons learned on that deal. And, you know, now I can say I know car washes. it did pay off the other day. By the way, it did pay off the other day because there's a brand new car wash in Seattle, and I went up to the guy and I said, yeah, let's talk car washes. And he did give me a free car wash after we shared stories.
Are you in an office or are you in a hotel room because you're staying in San Francisco?
I have a work-live loft in San Francisco.
Okay.
So I live half in Seattle and half in San Francisco.
I see. All right. What about Virtual I.O.?
So amazing company. At the time, one of the bigger ideas, the founders were a team that were real visionaries, very hardworking, very bright people. And they raised, there was a book written about Virtual I.O. The concept was virtual reality headsets. So definitely a question of timing, ahead of its time. I came in as VP of marketing and loved the vision of the thing. And we raised $50 million, which back then was a huge amount. The founders taught me a lot about fundraising. They were extremely good at it. But ultimately, the product didn't deliver to the consumer promise. The returns were high, defects were high, people had a different expectation of what the experience would be. You know, you're now seeing 3D movies, you're seeing 3D TVs. This stuff's coming, but we were 10, 15 years ahead of time.
Yeah, and it's still today coming. It's still a few years in the future.
That's right. I think it's still 5 years.
What about Evite? How'd you get into that, and how did that turn out for you?
Well, so Evite's a great story. Stanford MBA, I met these guys, and really within a half an hour, I said, I love this idea. I like their energy. I love the idea. It just made sense to me. And even to this day, I was so excited about it, and they're like, I don't know if we're going to take money, and maybe we should do a venture round. And I said, look, you guys, if you let me put money into this deal, I will paint my car with Evite all over it, and I will drive it around. They said, okay, you're in. And to this day, that is my car. I have a Volkswagen Bug from 1999 with pink and purple polka dots on it. It says Evite. And, I tried to give it to the Smithsonian, but they literally said there was no room, that they thought it was interesting. And I keep wanting to, Evite exists. So the outcome was it was a classic part of the bubble. We had some really big offers to buy Evite. And because the big venture funds came in, they were like, no, we shouldn't take, let's make up a number, $200-300 million. We need $1 billion. Now, as an angel investor in that deal, I would have been thrilled with $200 million. I mean, literally, I would have been done. I would have been retired. It would have been awesome. But as the angel and a small player, I had no voice around the table. And I would like pull them aside and I go, hey, we don't really have a revenue model here. We're growing and we're the de facto number one place to go for invitation. We don't have revenue. So don't you think we should maybe sell this now? So, hindsight's 20/20. But in the end, City Search, Ticketmaster bought it, not for very much money. And it's still today, and they've really done very little with it. It's very disappointing to me. But even today, it still is the number one player in that space.
And it's hard to dislodge them.
It's very hard. It's just shocking to me. Like, if I was Google, Google Calendar is growing like crazy. Why wouldn't you build Evite functionality into that?
You know,
hey, you guys over there. Free idea.
I talked to Harry Lynn, who ran that product for a while here on Mixergy. I talked to him, and he said that anytime he wanted to innovate, he just found himself locked. He found himself handcuffed. It was either that they were depending too much on the revenue that the company was making, and it's making a lot of revenue, and they didn't want to risk it, or the technology was just too hard to adjust, or they'd adjust, and then the users would say, what is this? I came here because it's dependable, and I know what I'm doing. Now I'm suddenly confused. And the people he was worried about weren't so much Google. He was worried about Facebook getting into the space.
Well, and Facebook I mean, it's just natural. You know, it's interesting. You asked me about people earlier. The team that started Evite, they're doing really interesting things. And just one small example is the president back then, founder, was Josh Silverman. Josh now runs Skype. And Skype, the numbers on Skype would blow you away. Their daily ads are in the hundreds of thousands. Every single day. Daily new subscribers.
Oh, hundreds of thousands of new people?
Every day.
Oh, wow.
So it's a little sleeper that's not a sleeper. And Josh is doing a great job there. And you know, I saw that. I saw that in him when we started with Evite.
I remember that he also was big on stunts to get attention. Anything to get people to understand that Evite was in the space. Now, I did talk about people. Here's another thing that I'm seeing. You're involved in lots of different businesses. Most people, they can't do one their whole lives. Here you are touching lots of different companies, making most of them work. How do you do it? What advice do you have for the rest of us who are trying to make one or two or three companies work in our lifetimes, not even over the course of a single year, but in our lifetimes?
Well, you know, I don't want to go to the level of platitudes and cliches.
Good.
But a lot of the things you hear people say are true. I will say this though, being lucky is part of it. But being lucky is, you know, someone once said, luck is the residue of design. So I'm going to give you an example that is peripheral, but maybe illustrates my point. If you're in San Francisco today and you're looking for a job, you have so much information about what companies are rising, whether it's, you know, and I'm not talking just about Google across the street. I'm not just talking about Zynga, although those are interesting companies. Why would you go work for a company that wasn't on the rise? Wouldn't you work really hard to get to know people? I call people at Google today, not because I want to go work at Google, because I know they're doing interesting stuff, and I know they're going to do interesting stuff after Google. Yeah, I love the lox and bagel I had this morning, but I know these people over here are really smart. Put yourself in front of success. That's, I have to say, at the end of the day, I never was the smartest guy in the room. I never was the one that had the big vision and executed perfectly. I just made sure I knew the people who could do those things or was part of the crowd doing those things. And it's funny to me, more people don't do that. You know, I love people who come in and say, I really am passionate about this. I want to start this company. And one of my first questions is, so, have you connected with others who have done that, who have had success? When I was, and I'm not suggesting this is the only way, but when I moved to Seattle, the first thing I did is I set up monthly coffee dates with successful entrepreneurs in Seattle that I didn't know. And one of my very first ones was with Howard Schultz. I said, Howard, you don't know me, but I would love to buy you a cup of coffee and talk to you for a half an hour because I love what you're doing. And he thought, this is weird, no one's ever done that, okay. Now or not today are friends. I mean, and he's a true inspiration for me. So I just got to tell you, get in front of success. We are so lucky today, you can figure out where that success boat is going. Get in front of it.
Okay, now once I'm in front, what next? What do you do? So let's say here I am, I meet you or somebody else meets you. They say, this is a smart guy. He's obviously in touch with everybody. I want to stay in front of him so that we can work together. Now, to just keep pestering you with emails to say, hey, John, so anything big going on is going to be annoying to you and you're going to start tossing me into spam.
You know,
what do we do?
So, look, people want to be with other interesting people. Yesterday, I met with the founder of StubHub. I haven't seen Jeff in a long time, but I wanted to see what he's working on. And he wants to know, what am I working on? And we want to exchange ideas. So you're going to be invited back to the dinner party if you're a good conversationalist, if you're bringing a new perspective, right? So get together with me. Like, this isn't the only way, but the D conference that just happened in San Diego, the TED conference, those are all great examples of people getting together to exchange really interesting ideas. Those are great examples of being connected to people that are changing the world. Okay, I love those things. I get inspired by those things. I love to share what I learned from those things. And I get new ideas from those things that I want to share back with those people. And so for me, that's my way. I'm not saying that everybody has to do it that way, but that's my way. And it really is, you know, what I love is I'm on LinkedIn and I'm on Facebook and I'm using them very experimentally. As you'll see, I have a lot of friends on those places. But I love the idea that we are so connected now that I can put out into the universe, hey, I'm going to Buenos Aires for the first time. If anybody knows people, doesn't mind connecting us, you know, from doing that on LinkedIn, I was met at the airport from someone I didn't know. I stayed in somebody's house I didn't know. I had lunches and dinners the whole week with people I'd never met before who are now lifelong friends just by putting it out there. And I'm not saying put it out there nilly-willy. You've got to bring something to the dinner party too, right? But don't be afraid to put it out there.
What do you bring to the...
I get calls all the time. And I really do try and do this as much as possible. Hey, would you just meet for a coffee? I've got this idea. I won't typically do it until I hear part of what the idea is. And I ask a few questions. How well have you thought about this? I don't want to be that first conversation, but I definitely want to help people think through ideas and connect them if I can. So I would just encourage people to really, first of all, we all have resources. We all have networks. Use the network you have. Use the resources you have right now. Okay? Start to build on that. And then as you build on that, one of my chief tenets in life is momentum creates momentum. Create some momentum for yourself. If you're having a bad day, figure out a momentum starter. I don't care if it's go out, you know, go work out and do 10 push-ups. Create momentum. I really believe in that concept. It's the same concept as there are two types of people in the world, those that suck energy and those that give you energy. Why would you ever want to be around people that suck energy? Right? And that's the way I try and do the business stuff. I don't know. It's probably not exactly the answer you're looking for.
No, it's exactly the answer I'm looking for. That, and maybe you don't even know the answer to this next question, but where do you get your energy? I feel like I've got a lot of energy, but I would like your kind of energy. Everybody who's watching us would love to have that kind of energy. Where does it come from?
You know, it's I am truly inspired by people. I can't, and I don't know. You know, maybe it's genetic. It's certainly not from an artificial substance. I can't even drink coffee. You
know? What's in the mug?
It's green tea. But I love being around Steve Ballmer, who's pounding the table and throwing things and fired up, because that gives me energy, right? I mean, maybe it's crazy, but I get fired up with that stuff, and I can't tell you why or how, but it's truly. I wake up every single day and I am psyched. Now, not everything's perfect. Not everything's going exactly as planned. But, you know, there's a lot to be thankful for.
All right. I got two other companies and then maybe we'll come back to Microsoft. Amazon. We talked before the interview with the live audience there about Amazon. You missed that opportunity, you said. Can you tell us about that?
Oh, I can. It's slightly embarrassing, but I guess... it's the truth, so I should tell it. I had an opportunity to be one of the first 10 investors in the company. I had a $10,000 check written, and I was going to hand it to Jeff, and that day I tore it up. And that would have been worth $20, $25 million. And the thing that I learned from that is Jeff is the answer. You know, I said, God, Barnes & Noble can do this. You know, Walmart can get in this way. Why is Amazon going to be the one? You know, and what I didn't what I didn't realize, I think Jeff is brilliant. And I did not appreciate how well he understood, for kind of a geek, how well he understood marketing and PR. How well he understood that by being the first in the e-commerce space, we don't even talk about e-commerce anymore, you know? By being the first in the e-commerce, he would become the poster child. If Newsweek, Time, The Economist, anybody was writing a story on e-commerce, they had to talk about Amazon because they were one of the first examples. And Jeff utilized that more brilliantly than I've ever seen anyone do it. And he also, you know, he did stuff that was very counterintuitive. People now forget. They lost so much money. And he would say, yeah, that's our plan. Right? What do you mean? We know we're losing money. We got to build to spend. We got to spend to build. It's infrastructure. And he was right. And people were like, oh, that's interesting. Boy, it doesn't quite make sense to me, but oh, okay. Jeff's great. So I blew it. I mean, I'll be the first to say it. And I really respect what Jeff's done and is doing. And think today he still doesn't get, you know, you hear about Steve Jobs, you know, you hear about Google. I think Jeff is truly one of the greats.
I think he's starting to get that respect again. There was a time there where everyone said, you must be an idiot. Look at what happened to the whole Web 1.0. He's the poster child of all that failure. And then they came around again. Total Beauty, run by my friend Emra. He and I went to high school in Brooklyn together. I saw that you're on the board. How'd you get involved with them, and what is it about them?
I was a minor founder, I guess I'll say. I was an early advisor. But my friend John Hadel connected with Emra, and they co-founded it, really. And I helped him early on, talked about business ideas. And I love Emra. I think he's doing a fantastic job there. I love the fact that here's a guy who worked at a big company, P&G, and you wouldn't necessarily think that a guy there could make the switch to an entrepreneurial kind of role, and he's done it. I give him a lot of credit. And, you know, another piece of advice, go where the space is big. You know, beauty is a big space. Travel is a big space. Wine is a big space. You know, go where the space is big, because sometimes that the bigness of the space is like the rising tide. You get to take advantage of the fact that there's so many opportunities. And I think, yeah, there's other players in the beauty space, but there's room for more than one player. So I love what those guys are doing. And he's a great example of an entrepreneur I'd back again. Emra, if you're out there listening to this, tell me what you're going to do next, and I'm there.
Schmoozefest. That's something that I saw in an old article on you when I did some research. You apparently
invest. Like, what was that? You're like the guy who does the James Lipton. the movie. Yeah. I found this high school yearbook picture of you, and so that was back in the day, the bubble days. And I'll tell you, Schmoozefest started from the notion that, well, really what we've been talking about, that networking and connecting with people is an integral part of the ecosystem that makes Silicon Valley what it is. It's amazing. In this town, and I'll fly in for 10 days a month, in this town, every single night of the week, there is 2, 3, 4, 10 different events you could go to that are entrepreneurs connecting in some way. And in Seattle, it wasn't happening. And I just thought to myself, it doesn't have to be complicated. Let's just say once a month, we're going to have an opportunity for people to connect. And the thing started with 30, 40 people. And by the end, it was almost 1,000 people. I had to, actually finding a venue for it was crazy. And it got, you know, to this day, I still have people who thank me because there were marriages that came out of it. But really, my goal was just to let people have an opportunity to meet other people and share ideas.
How do you make those events useful? Because a lot of us go to events that are just supposed to be business passing events, and they're not really as useful as some of the events you mentioned earlier, the TEDs and the rest of the world. How?
Well, again, you know, a couple things I do, and they may or may not work for the audience. I really try and have one great conversation, right? That's a goal I go into these things. And if I have had one great conversation, what's a great conversation? Someone that has an idea that I hadn't thought of, someone that clearly inspires, someone that, you know, maybe down the road there's an opportunity. great conversation where I'm going to stay connected to the ideas or that person. That then it's a successful event. The other thing is, I have made a concerted effort to make sure that I know people at Google, at Facebook, at LinkedIn, at Zynga, okay, right? And so I know that somehow I'm going to need to know what's going on at those companies or get some insight, and I just want to make sure, and at these events, those people go to them, right? The other thing that I've always done is I try and find a young person who's clearly passionate, who's clearly doing some right things, and get to know them. Because it's not about the event. It's not about next week. It's about the next 10 years.
Well, all right, we've talked a lot about the big successes and one little thing that you've missed, about a failure, a big failure that maybe changed the course of your life afterwards.
Well, I've had a lot of failures, so it's not a problem trying to find one. You know, the thing about being an entrepreneur, the thing about, you know, venture capital, by the way, is all about failure. If you're a successful venture capitalist, you're like the baseball player who hits 300s in the Hall of Fame. Most of what you do is failure. So you can't be afraid of failure, and you do your best to learn every single time. But the rawest one for me right now, and I guess it's not maybe in the failure category, but it's been a very tough road. Last year I started a company called Amicus. And Amicus comes out of the notion that the country and the world have a problem around disaster response, whether it's Katrina or Ike or earthquakes or hurricanes or floods. We don't do a very good job. And yet, technology now is such that there are solutions out there if we could somehow collaborate and come together on this. So Amicus, E-M-I-C-U-S, was an idea that you go and you have a portal where, using social media, using citizen journalism, using crowdsourcing, you could actually do a mashup and put on a map, where's water, where's gas, where's shelter, what traffic changes are happening, where are places you shouldn't go, and allow both authenticated reports and also the citizens to update this. Now, I believe that this is needed and will save lives. But getting different constituencies to actually come on board and partner on this, we failed. We have some, but it's been really hard. And it's frustrating to me because at this point, I don't care if I ever see a dime from it, but it should be in the world, right? It has to be in the world. And so, you know, FEMA knows us, and we've talked to them, and we said to FEMA, we'll give it to you. And government's like, well, we can't really do that. You know, and now we're at the point where the team, which was a very passionate team, has had to move on and go get paying jobs, it turns out. I understand that. But, you know, our last effort here is to find, you know, give it to Google, give it to Yahoo, give it to Microsoft, give it to an insurance company, but give it to someone so it's in the world. And I'm pretty frustrated that we didn't get that done. But it doesn't mean I'm any less passionate about the reason for having done it.
I see. And it does look like something Google thinks is important also. And I've heard and I've seen them try to bring this together. And still No one's done it. And definitely not exactly the way that you're talking about.
Exactly.
And the big hit, was that StubHub? The biggest?
The big hit. I don't know. I mean, I've been very fortunate. I haven't had the grand hit, but I've had some nice wins, and StubHub was one of them for sure.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you for doing the interview with me. How can people connect with you? What's a good place for them to find you?
Well, you know, if you want to, unfortunately, I have too many friends on Facebook, which frustrates me, but because they limit it to a certain number. But Hand of God Wines on Facebook, if you're at all interested in following what we're doing. Certainly, Twitter is Stainman, Stainman. And if you want to send an email, it's fine. John, J-O-N, at handofgodwines.com, handgodwines.com. And I hope to see you in Buenos Aires. I'll be there in October and December.
If I'm not here, then maybe I'll see you back in the U.S. when I come back.
Fantastic.
Cool.
Fantastic.
Good to meet you, John. Thank you all for watching.
Go USA.
Go USA. You should see the office over here. They got the white and blue everywhere. If I'm the one guy cheering the U.S., we'll see what happens.
It's fantastic. Yeah. So, all right, man.
Thank you. Bye.
Cheers. Peace.